Church is an instrument of His glory, and the church that meets here at this place seeks to do that, to honor Him through what we do, through what we teach, through the encouragement that we offer, through the prayers that we offer to Him, and the worship that we engage in. We're glad that you are here with us doing those things this morning. Again, so appreciative for the time that we can spend together. Please turn, if you would, to Philippians chapter 4. Maybe put your finger there or put your ribbon there. We'll be looking at Philippians chapter 4 in just a moment. I want to encourage all of you this morning to think with me. Not because this is going to be an especially intellectually challenging sermon. Those of you who know me well, I'm not a philosopher. I'm not really going to put to you many really intellectually taxing concepts. But I want you to think about what we're talking about this morning, because I believe that that is exactly what the Scriptures call upon us to do at all times when we are considering things of spiritual merit. I've said this many times from this place. Christianity, a relationship with God, no matter what dispensation we happen to be under. We are Christians today. People have followed God for many generations. But that relationship has always been for those who think. Christianity is not for people who just simply sit. It is not simply for people who exist and are and don't give any thought to anything beyond that, just existing day to day. It is for people who are willing to be involved in thought, critical thinking, careful thinking, consistent thinking. We see this pointed out in the Scriptures a number of times, I believe. Deuteronomy chapter 6 would be one instance. As Moses has delivered the law to the people, he encourages them to keep it, but they will only be able to keep it by thinking about it regularly and involving themselves in thought and meditation and contemplation of that law. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 9, we see this passage and read it frequently. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. When Jesus quotes this passage in the New Testament, it's interesting that we see that final word, strength, as the New King James Version reads. That is read mind in the New Testament. You love Him with everything that you've got, including your mental faculties that are exercised in knowing how to love Him and why to love Him and what that actually means. And of course, He'll go on to say that these words that I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Is he telling the people there that they need to be thinking about what they're doing when they obey the Lord, that those commandments need to be in their minds, always rolling around in there a little bit? In Isaiah chapter 1, the 18th verse, as the great prophet Isaiah is really beginning his prophecy to the people, he speaks the words of the Lord there in saying, "Come now and let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be as wool." Come now, let us reason together. I want you to think about what I am about to tell you, people, he is saying. I want you to engage in some exercise of reason with me. Jesus stressed the need for this and really pointed out what was lacking in those who heard him. Look in the 16th chapter of Matthew. In Matthew chapter 16, the first verse of that chapter tells us that the Pharisees and Sadducees came and, testing him, asked that he would show them a sign from heaven. Well, Jesus gave many signs from heaven. He was not averse to working miracles for the benefit of the people who observed those things, to prove that he was from heaven, to prove that he was exactly what his claims made him out to be. But listen to how he answers in verse 2. He answered and said to them, "When it's evening, you say, 'It will be fair weather, for the sky is red.' And in the morning, 'It will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening.' Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times." He says, "I've already done miracles for you. I've already shown you some things that if you had been thinking about them, if you can exercise the same judgment, seeing what I've been doing, that you exercise when you look at the sky and figure out what the weather's going to be like, if you were capable of that critical, rational thought in a spiritual sense, you wouldn't need to be asking for more signs. You would be able to figure those things out. Finally, in the 17th chapter of Acts, we begin seeing a running record that Luke gives us as Paul and his companions are going to these various churches, many of them Greek churches. But we see in chapter 17, chapter 18, chapter 19, we won't read all of these passages together, but verse 2 of chapter 17 in the book of Acts is fairly representative for this whole section of narrative, where it tells us that Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures in the synagogue, explaining and demonstrating that the Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus whom I preach is the Christ." We see the same thing in verse 17 of the chapter, chapter 18, verse 4, verse 19, verse 28, Acts 19, verses 8 and 9. Everywhere Paul goes, what's he doing with those people? He's giving them reason. He's giving them logic. He's inviting them to think with him, to engage their minds in what they're doing. I wonder if we have over-romanticized simple, childlike faith. The idea that all you need to do to be pleasing to God is just believe, just have faith in Him. Now, I am absolutely not discounting the need for faith. Faith is incredibly important. But the biblical version of faith seems to be a more informed faith, a more serious faith, a more thoughtfully considered faith than the type advocated by much of the world today and often found even within the church, which tends to be oftentimes a lazy faith that says, I can just believe because that spares me from thinking. I can just assume some things because that spares me from weighing the facts and looking at the evidence and actually seeing what is there to consider. This fourth chapter of Philippians, verses 8 and 9, if you had that marked a moment ago, return to it with me. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9 is a passage that we need to think about. We need to dwell upon it carefully, as the verse itself even instructs us to do. Perhaps because of its immediate context, found within a discussion of the peace of God, that peace which surpasses all understanding, as verse 7 describes it. Maybe this well-known passage has its legs cut off and is weakened to approximately, think about nice things when times are rough, and this will bring you peace. In fact, what Paul is doing here is describing to us the means, the requirements for a true and all-encompassing peace with God. But he is also wrapping up his instructions to the Philippians by encouraging them to do exactly what we observed a moment ago, to think and to think hard if you want to have anything to do with God. Verse 8 of Philippians chapter 4, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you." I think we can make a few observations from this passage that will hopefully inspire within us some thought about what we are doing, what we need to be doing as Christians, as people who follow the Lord. First of all, please observe, these virtues amount basically to us making sure that we are sorting out what is and what is not truthful. They have everything to do with actual, absolute truth and with the concrete teaching of Christ and His apostles. Verse 8 is tied directly to verse 9. These things that he is talking about, he says, are also those things that you learned and received and heard and saw in me. This is what you have to do. They're viewed in the life of this apostle, and they're viewed in the teaching of this apostle who taught the gospel of Christ, who taught doctrine that was given to him by the Lord himself. The list begins with things that are true in verse 8 and goes on to give in those six and, well, eight if we expand it to those final two that are just sort of summarizing. Six different terms that are roughly comparable to that idea. Things that are truthful. Things that are noble or honorable. They are worthy of belief. They are lovely. They are things that inspire goodwill when they are considered. They're of good report. They are pure. They're not corrupted and they're not given to wrong motivations and so forth. All of these things are roughly comparable to the idea that we have to sort out what is true, and what is true is found in what the apostles taught and heard, or rather what was heard from them and what was seen from them, the doctrine and the lives that they exhibited. Our first concern with where we let our minds dwell has to be, am I thinking or am I thinking about doing something that is approved by God? Am I letting my mind lead me somewhere that I have the authority to go? Are both my intentions and my decisions, my actions, are those things based upon what is truthful? Is that my guiding light? Is that my principle that I follow everywhere? Am I thinking about things that are true? Did Christ teach it? Did He speak it? Did His apostles authorize it? Is it truthful? We miss this mark sometimes. Churches in the world miss this regularly. The first question instead might be, does it increase our numbers? Does it bring more people in through the doors? Does it create an exciting emotional state? Is it going to get everybody really happy, get everybody bouncing on their feet a little bit? Will this teaching hurt anyone's feelings? I'd really rather not offend anyone if I can avoid that, and really, even if I can't avoid it, I just am not going to say anything that's going to hurt someone's feelings. Is it something popular? Is it widely accepted? Would somebody laugh at me for teaching this kind of doctrine or believing this kind of concept? Those are no substitute for leaders with the courage and wisdom to ask above anything else, is it truthful? If I'm thinking about it or if I'm considering doing it, is it true? We miss that mark as a whole because churches are made up of people and individuals. People so frequently have their priorities all askew when it comes to their thoughts. This passage has a fundamentally important personal application as well. Do I personally care about acting with authority? What I do, what I believe, what I teach, what I engage in as a Christian, am I on firm ground when I do that? Do I consider, is the thought passing through my mind that what I'm doing is truthful and noble and pure and lovely and of good report and of virtue and praiseworthy by God because it's right and it's what He has authorized me to do? The elders do have a responsibility to shepherd and guide and correct and nurture, but ultimately it's not the church's responsibility. It's my personal responsibility to serve and to live and to worship within the bounds that are created by New Testament teaching. Of course, I arrive there only through great effort, and that's the second thing I believe we observe about this. Paul is urging deep thought here. These words that are used to describe this Christian mindset, they're not casual words. They're not just, well, you kind of chew on that for a little bit. Just kind of sit down and have a think about it. Maybe sleep on it for a couple of nights. The idea here is consistent measured thought. He says in verse 8 to meditate on these things. Some versions might say to let your mind dwell on these things. You're regularly giving thought to them. Consistently giving thought to these virtuous things. Do we really and truly think about things that are important? I want you to just, as I say frequently, I can't tell you yes or no on these. I don't know what's going on in your mind. You don't know what's going on in my mind. That's not a power that any of us have to answer definitively for each other the thoughts and the motivations of our hearts and minds. Just think for yourself, though. How did I decide where to worship? What church to be a part of? How did I arrive at that conclusion? Did I give careful thought to that? What do I do when I hear a religious teacher saying something that maybe doesn't quite sound right, does that bother me? Is that something that gives me any reaction whatsoever? Am I capable of figuring out if that teaching is right or not? Do I know why I'm here at worship services today? Why are you here? Did you think about that? Did you just show up because it's Sunday and it's 9:30 and that's where I am? That's what I do. Did you think about it this morning? We partook of emblems symbolizing the death of Christ, His body, His blood, this morning. Did you think about that? Did you know what we were doing when we observed those things? When we passed those plates by and gave? Were we doing it like some of our young children who just want to put some change in there because it makes a satisfying clink noise and we see everybody else doing it? Or do we know, did we think about what I'm doing when I give back to the Lord? Have I thought about what I'm doing when I'm at worship? Do I really know the God that I'm worshiping? Paul, in his message to the Athenians, spoke to them of that unknown God. We might be worshiping an unknown God to us sometimes. We've not really thought about who He is, how He acts in our lives, what relationship we have with Him. How much do I really know about Jesus? Right now, this moment, this morning, how well versed are you in the doctrine that Jesus actually taught? How familiar are you with what the Son of God actually said while He was here upon the earth? How much do you know about what He did? How much do you know about what His character was like? What does God demand of me? Specifically and exactly me, as a person, right now, this moment, what does He want from me? If I'm a father, what does He ask of fathers? As a spouse, as a child, as a worker, what are His expectations of me? As a church member, as a leader in the church? What exactly does God want from me in those situations in my life? Do I have a plan for my life? Do I think about spiritual growth? Growth does not happen just because it happens. We're not trees, spiritually speaking. We're not just things that are planted into the ground and, well, that just grows because that's nature. Christians do not grow that way. We grow because we put in effort, because we allow God to equip us to grow, because we allow the influence of others to continue building us up and strengthening us and fortifying us. Do we have a plan for that? Is that something that you've given thought to this week, this month, this year? Am I growing? And if not, how in the world am I going to do that? How do I accomplish perfection and holiness? Do I know what to do when I'm tempted to sin? You're going to be tempted to sin, possibly today. Surely this week, you're going to find yourself in a situation where you have a branching road in front of you, and Satan very, very much wants you to take this left-hand path. Do you know what to do when that happens? Do you know how to stand up to him? Do I know how to respond in other times of trial? When tragedy comes? When I'm grief-stricken? When I'm mourning? Do I know what to do in those situations? Or am I going to be lost and adrift and foundering the first time that I find myself in a difficult spot? Am I able to communicate to others clearly and easily and perhaps even enthusiastically why I am a Christian? Why they should be a Christian? How they can be a Christian? Am I ready for that? If your waitress were to come to you this afternoon when you're at lunch and say, you look dressed up like you've been at church. Why were you there? What were you doing there? Is that something I should be doing? Tell me how I should know it's something I should be doing. Would we just not have any idea what to do? Maybe hand them a bulletin and pawn that off on someone else? Call this person? I'm happy to be called for that reason, but can we give an answer as Peter would encourage us to do for the hope that is within us? With issues that I debate fiercely with others during a regular week, political issues, moral issues, perhaps even spiritual ones, those hot button kind of topics that come up around the workplace or among friends. Abortion, racism, welfare, social responsibilities, gay rights, capital punishment, military actions that our country is taking. When I debate those things so hotly with other people, do I know what God says about those topics? Or am I just using my own reasoning, making things up as I go, going with what I feel would be right? Or have I thought about those issues that are very important to other people and to our society? With small-scale things, everyday kind of issues, when a situation becomes heated at work, when the kids are misbehaving and test my patience, when I'm arguing with my spouse, when I'm mistreated by someone in a position of authority over me, when my parents make a decision that I don't agree with or like, do I think first as a rule, or do I feel first? Or even worse, do I act first? Am I governed by my thoughts, by rational thinking, by what is truthful? Again, I can't answer those questions, but careful thought. Let your mind dwell on truthful, honorable, approved things which God deems praiseworthy and attractive and useful. That is what we need to be doing with our minds. We fill ourselves, we fill our minds with all kinds of things that are not at all what's described in Philippians 4, verse 8. Things that are not true, things that are not noble, things that are not honorable, things that are not praiseworthy or lovely or pure or of good report or virtuous. Some of them are neutral. Many of them, quite frankly, are absolutely destructive and useless and terrible. Those come into our airspace and we don't banish them. We don't do as Paul would tell the Corinthians, take every thought captive. Give careful thought to good things. Be prepared for every situation that might arise. That is what the Scriptures call us to do, to meditate on things that are useful to people who have an inclination towards pleasing God. A third and final observation that we see in this passage very clearly, as always, thought has action in mind as its natural end. Thinking never takes place in a vacuum when the Scriptures are concerned. There's always the idea of acting within them. After thinking carefully, we must practice those truthful things. Do them. Act upon them. What does he say in verse 9? The things which you learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do. Some versions might say these practice. Thinking about things is great, but thought is worthless without action. You can think about something all day. Or even talk about something all day. It's similar to what James would say about faith and works. If you find some poor man who's hungry and cold and in a very dire straits, and you say to him, be warmed, be filled, and turn on your heel and walk away. That helped him an awful lot, didn't it? That didn't do anything. Talk is cheap. Thinking even cheaper in terms of actually accomplishing something. Action must be backing these things up. You practice these things. These things you do and put into action. Otherwise, there is no worth to them ultimately. Matthew chapter 7 finds Jesus concluding his greatest and most well-known section of teaching, the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus concludes all of those wonderful words, all of that priceless instruction by offering the same invitation that we're talking about right now, to do something about it. Verse 24 of Matthew 7, whoever therefore hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. You can hear a lot of great instruction from the Scriptures. You can think about a lot of things that are noble and useful and worthy of your time and worthy of your thought. But if you don't do those things, You're the foolish man. You're the one with no founding. You're the one with no base. You're the one that's going to be just pushed over at the first rainstorm. Thought is worthless without action. We must be doing. Just as surely, though, poor or foolish thinking leads to poor or foolish acting. Whether we want it to be true or not, actions follow thoughts. The mind determines what the body will do. Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 7 is a familiar thought to much of the world, not even speaking of religious people. This is a concept that is known by many people, many different philosophers. As he thinks in his heart, so is he. As a man thinks, so he is. You are going to do what you think about doing. You are going to say what you think about saying. You cannot be two people living within the same body. The mind that has some stuff that it thinks about, and then the acting part, the body, that does some other things. Eventually, we will be betrayed by our thoughts, whether that is good or whether that is bad. We are right now, as we speak, as you sit there thinking, hopefully, and not daydreaming or not the kind of dreaming you do with your eyes closed because you're unconscious. As you sit there thinking right now, you are writing out the code in your minds that will determine the tasks that your bodies will carry out for the rest of the day, for the rest of the week, for the rest of the month, for the rest of the year. Think of it in terms of a computer. You put a program into it. It doesn't start doing something else on its own. That's science fiction stuff where machines come to life and start doing things totally contrary to what they've been programmed to do. You give it a program, it executes it. Well, humans are not so different. Some people have likened human beings to a computer made out of meat. I think there's some truth to that. What we put into our minds, how we program ourselves, what we are thinking about, those are the tasks we're going to execute. Input matches the output. What do we think about? Things that are noble, things that are true, things that are just, righteous, things that are pure, things that are of good report, things that are virtuous, things that are praiseworthy. If you think about those things, you have a mind to act, you have a mind to obey the Lord, you're going to do good things. You're going to be a person who lives righteously. You're going to be a person who is useful to the people around you. You're going to be a person who accomplishes good in the kingdom of God. Now, if we do not think about things that are true and noble and just and pure and lovely and of good report and praiseworthy, why on earth would we expect that we will do things that are true or just or pure or praiseworthy? What do you think about? How are you using your mind? I pray, I fervently pray this morning that we're meditating on things that are useful, that we are putting a good program into our minds and thinking about things that will ultimately make us people that bring pleasure to God. The final result of this in verse 9, the apostle concludes that bit of instruction and really concludes his instructions in general to this church in Philippi by saying that if you do these things, if that is the case, that you have in mind useful thoughts, that you are exercising all of your mental faculties in good pursuits, and if you're practicing those things that you've seen from myself and from the other apostles, there is a result of that. The God of peace will be with you. This morning, I offer to those who would have an ear to hear, we offer peace. We perhaps don't speak of it that frequently when we're extending an invitation to those who might have need to respond. But one of the greatest things that we secure in obeying the Lord, in responding to the gospel, is that itself, is peace. Is there anything better than being able to pillow your head at night, knowing, not thinking, knowing, being convicted to your roots, to your core? If the Lord were to return right now, I would be with Him. If something were to happen to me this evening as I sleep and I were to not wake up from this sleep, I would be with the Lord. He has forgiven me my sins. I am found pleasing in His sight. Because of His Son's death, because of the blood that Christ shed on the cross, when the Lord looks at me, He calls me righteous. Is there anything that brings more peace than those thoughts? To know that we are found by a God who looks at us and deems us worthy and acceptable to Him. Contrast that with, can you think of anything more horrifying than to be unsure of those things? To wonder, if I am to leave this place and get out onto the Thunderdome-type streets of Houston, America, driving around out there on the highway with the rest of the crazy folks, and something were to happen to me and my life ended at 1 o'clock this afternoon, I have no idea where my soul would be. It's a toss-up. It's a coin flip. Maybe I've been good enough. Maybe I haven't. I've done some good, some bad. I've listened to the Lord on a few things. I'm kind of lacking on some other things. I think for the most part I've obeyed what He wants me to do. But to be honest, who can really know? I'm unsure. Is there anything, maybe I'm alone in this, is there anything more terrifying than that thought, to be unsure? What would happen to me if I were to leave this earth right now? I want to know. I want to be sure. I want to have that kind of peace. And that's what Paul promises. You involve your mind in good, noble, truthful pursuits. You involve your body in following after those things. The God of peace will be with you. God will be with you in what you'll do. And you can have the peace that comes with that life, a life of obedience and service to a God who is just, who rewards those who follow Him. We offer that peace this morning. It can be secured only by obeying the Lord, by being found righteous in Him. If you need this morning to do that, to render obedience to the gospel of Christ, come and do that. Repent of your sins. Put away those things that are contrary to your life itself, those things that are harmful and damaging to you on every possible level of existence. Don't have anything to do with that anymore. Obey the Lord and walk in His ways, walk in His paths. Be baptized into His death. Be buried with Christ so that you can be raised with Christ and walk with Christ. That gives peace that cannot be purchased through any other means. And it does surpass all understanding. All of our highest thoughts cannot really even understand how wonderful a blessing that is. If you need that this morning, let us help you in obeying the Lord, receiving those blessings. Come forward right now while we stand and sing this. Hear the three voices of Jesus say.